This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City at 99.5 FM.
I witness an interview with Dr. Herbert Needleman of the Committee of Responsibility, an organization of physicians working to bring severely injured civilians from Vietnam to the United States for therapy and restorative surgery. The interview was broadcast live over WBAI, July 8th of 1970. The interviewer is Bill Schechner, and the first voice heard is Dr. Needleman.
First statistics about civilian war casualties were released by the government of Vietnam. It was then the Key government in late 1966, and they were that there would be 50,000 civilians admitted to the hospitals with war injuries in the year 1966. Now, our studies and Kennedy's studies have indicated that for every person who gets into the hospital, there are two or three who never make it. So we're really talking about perhaps 150 to 200,000 civilians killed or wounded every year.
When you say hospital, what do you mean? Well, I know what I think of, but
right.
It's probably far different from what you're talking
about. It's incredible. Before I went to Vietnam, I talked to every physician I could. I read everything. I looked at all the pictures, and nothing prepared me to walk into an average provincial hospital. The province is like a state, and the provincial hospital is located in the capital of each province, so that there would be one provincial hospital in Albany if this were applied to the United States, and one in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They were built by the French, which makes them 30 years old. They're low.
Minimal, right?
Right, minimally. Many of the buildings go back further than that. They're crumbling. They have no screens on the windows. The toilets are all blocked up with excrement, are unusable. There's garbage in the courtyards, garbage in the hospital corridors. The initial thing that happens when you walk into to a Vietnamese hospital is the odor of excrement and pus and garbage. It hits you just like a physical blow. It's incredible. Weeks after I came back, I couldn't get that stench out of my nostrils. And then you see people, two and sometimes three to a bed, and sometimes on the patients on the floor or on litters. You see flies walking all over open wounds because, as I said, there are no screens. The Vietnamese family structure is a tight one so that the family stays there and patiently fans the flies off the children or the adults. Walk into the operating rooms, air conditioning generally doesn't work so that the place is hot. And again, flies, and terrible amounts of filth. Electric power is intermittent, so that there may be one light bulb per corridor, one light bulb per ward. That doesn't matter because there are no attendants at night. In the afternoon, everybody goes home, and the patients are left to their families, if there are any families there for care. Water supply. In many places, there's not running water in these hospitals. That's the situation for the people who are lucky enough to get to the hospital.
So then, it would be fair to say that a hospital really is a hospital only in the sense of it's a collection of people who need treatment, who are put together, and there are a certain amount of limited facilities. But in terms of antiseptic care or medical equipment, that kind of stuff, it really is not a hospital as we know it, is it?
Right. I would say, and I think I'm being fair to this, that although there are a lot of well-trained people working there and working very hard, that a hospital in Vietnam must be fairly similar to a hospital in our Civil War. Well, there's more anesthesia, more modern drugs, but in general the surgery is of that nature. It's acute, radical surgery to amputate limbs, save lives, etc. There's very little elective surgery done. People who need elective surgery may have to wait months and sometimes a year or so to get into the OR. And the filth and squalor is incredible.
There must be a considerable amount of all kinds of communicable infections in these hospitals, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people who probably burn cases are extremely susceptible to infection.
Right.
I would imagine that cases who come in, and if they were... if facilities were more adequate, would be discharged successfully after a stay, probably die in the hospital.
Not in the hospital, because the Vietnamese family structure is tight, and they don't want, when they see that a member of their family is failing, they take them home so that they can die at home, because they believe the spirit is emitted at the time of death, and they want that spirit to reside in the home. So that the death rate in many hospitals is very low, because when the person starts sinking, the family will take him out, and that's kind of encouraged by the hospital staff, too. Yeah, the surgery and the medical care is very primitive. I've seen in some of the better hospitals, I saw a fresh burn case right next to a case of open typhoid fever. So, you know, the infection rates are incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. How is the professional staff? Is there a professional staff outside of a few physicians?
Well, there are 1,000 Vietnamese physicians in Vietnam, but 700 are in the military. So it leaves about 300 for the rest of the population. Of that 300, about half have lucrative private practices in the city. So for the rural population of Vietnam, 14 million people, there are about 150 Vietnamese physicians. It's about 100,000 potential patients per doctor. That's supplemented to some degree by American physicians, military and civilian, on loan to the Vietnamese government. The same kind of ratios apply to nurses. Nursing shortages, there are huge shortages of nurses and midwives, technicians, etc. And all the other backup things like garbage collectors, sanitary engineers, sterilizing machine runners, you know. The whole system is just crumbling.
What does it look like in one of these hospitals? I was going to ask you to describe what happens to a patient after he comes in, but maybe it would be more graphic to just describe a ward.
Sure. The hospitals are generally of the single one-story tropical architecture with clay roofs. And I've seen patients come into the courtyard after a strike or after there's been some action out in the hillside, come in by their own means. I've seen actually a family come in on a bed with a member of the family on each corner of a bed. And then they're brought to the emergency unit where the immediate triage is done. If the person can be helped, the immediate first aid is given. Then they're shuffled off to a ward, which looks, there are two rows of beds down and a narrow corridor separating them, and in each bed there are usually two people, or often two people, sometimes three children to a bed. The most characteristic thing, is, just to be redundant, is the odor. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Everything just feels dirty. There's a kind of slippery feeling about everything. Attendants are scarce. The Vietnamese, I want to be careful I say this, they're a stoic people. They don't weep and scream a lot, but I don't mean to say that they don't feel pain. A lot of people are given to the kind of myth, well, that Asians are used to suffering, etc., and they don't mind it. They mind it just as badly as anybody else. They just don't make a lot of noise about it. They suffer very quietly, and you can hear, even on a pediatric ward, very little crying, very little loud crying. You hear whimpering and moaning from even the most severely wounded people, and I've seen terribly burned children in Vietnam. It's one of the points at issue. You know, when we first formed our committee, we began to speak very clearly. I think we were one of the few American groups that were speaking clearly about civilian casualties, and suddenly a number of witnesses popped up. They continue to pop up, who have never seen napalm children. They say they've never seen a napalmed civilian. This is an important point to me, because I think it's easy to find volunteers who have not seen certain kinds of wounds. One's reminded of a story told by Lincoln. He was supposed to have been prosecuting a man for murder, and because he had supplied three witnesses who saw the man pull the trigger, so the defense found five witnesses who did not see the man pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after we began to talk about what we had seen, a number of eminent people, including Dr. Rusk of this city, reported that they had not seen napalm in their visits, napalm victims in their visits to Vietnam. Well, I have. I have in every surgical facility I visited in I Corps, and that was six hospitals.
That's the, this is WBAI in New York City. That's the first corps, the northernmost.
Right. From area. The demilitarized zone down to Da Nang, just about.
Right.
It's where the fighting has been the hottest. That's where most of the napalm has been dropped. And if you go to those hospitals and if you ask questions, if you ask to be shown napalm casualties, you'll see them. They're there.
Do they, are the predominant, are most of the people in the hospitals victims of burn via napalm?
No. No, not a lot. You don't see a lot of them, and that's because most of them die. If there is a strike and the napalm is dropped, the people who were in the center of the strike don't live very long.
Mm-hmm.
If there were people burned on the outskirts of Manhattan and it took over 2 hours to get to a hospital, many of them would die from shock in the process. And most Vietnamese take 8 to 24 hours to get to a hospital because they commit by their own means. So that the only napalm victims one sees in the hospital tend to be the milder ones are people who, by some kind of miracle of resiliency, survived long enough to get in.
I remember in the material I read in the Washington Post, reports of what, at least to my mind as a layman, seemed to be extremely primitive and reverse treatment of burns.
Yeah, that was the burn unit at Da Nang. It's an incredible story, and I've witnessed the same kind of thing. George Roth, that was George Roth's third visit to Vietnam, so he speaks from some experience, described in that report walking into the burn unit and watching a very competent and a very compassionate Vietnamese nurse change dressings for this whole unit of burn children. She had one bathtub filled with water, and she would place the child standing in that bathtub, and the mother who was there would then begin to lave the child with water in a small pan, and as the water hit the child, he would start crying because it's painful, and then as the
crying, as I remember, is an understatement.
Yeah,
screaming, right.
And then as the dressings loosened, the nurse would peel them off, and the child was left like a bright red lobster with this open skin. And then the child stepped out, and to George's amazement, another child stepped into the same bathwater, and the process began again. And for the entire unit in the Da Nang burn ward, there was one single tub of water used. George felt that the nurse in charge of this was an incredibly competent woman. That's all she had to deal with, and she was stoic and at the same time compassionate. But this is not unique. Da Nang is one of the bigger and better hospitals. It's one in which more American money has been put in than many others.
Just to step sideways for a minute, Da Nang is the major American base in the northern portion of South Vietnam.
Right.
Do civilian casualties get into American military hospitals?
Well, on a limited basis.
How limited?
Quite limited.
Limited enough to say that it's virtually has no impact?
Well, very little has any impact on when you're dealing with a problem of these dimensions. I guess about a year and a half ago, Ted Kennedy began to put some pressure on the Department of Defense, since there are many empty beds in American military hospitals, that they be utilized for
WBAI New York
civilian care. There was some opening of access to these beds, but the House Armed Services Committee interfered with this to a certain degree, and while technically there is admissibility into these hospitals, it's very difficult. John Balaban, who was another one of our workers, described seeing a very badly injured kid show up at the door of a military hospital and be turned away because the child hadn't come first through the usual admission route, which is the village dispensary. This child short-circuited that route and was not admitted and died because of this technicality. Now, I can't say that that happens all the time, but I do know that there are many civilians who need care who are not getting into our military hospitals and are suffering because of it.
I think I'm correct in saying that the military hospitals, and I don't know if it's a policy or whether it's I don't know if it's written policy or whether it's just pragmatic policy, but they operate at high levels of capacity in respect to the ratio of beds in use to beds available not anywhere near 1-to-1.
Right.
They keep it that way purposely because they say they need reserve capacity, but the effect of it is to have a lot of empty beds in the military hospitals most of the time.
That's exactly right. That's calculated policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's in their guidelines or manuals of procedure that...
Which seems incredible to me that there isn't sufficient flexibility to use these beds much closer to capacity, and if something happens where they need the beds, to move people around and create beds.
Yeah, medical care for GIs in Vietnam and in this country, the acute medical care is excellent. You know, there have been grave questions raised about rehabilitative care once the person gets out of the acute installation. And in the evac and field hospitals in Vietnam, it's excellent. And I agree with you. I don't think it would be compromised if they increased the utilization of the facilities, and certainly this would help the Vietnamese. But it just has to be said that our concern for the Vietnamese civilian is very slight. I mean, you don't have to be a super sleuth just to put the pieces together. It's a low order of priority, and it only exists as a priority because at one point, our government thought there was political mileage in it. Our medical programs in Vietnam were widely advertised as being our most important weapon in winning the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. Weapon was the word used, and this was advertised at the American Medical Association convention. Now, that's an obscenity. Medical care is not a weapon. It's a service that you deliver to make a living, or because you have a skill that people need. You don't use it in order to make people like you or subscribe to your political beliefs. But because our government has perverted it to these ends, the quality of it must suffer. Because the initial goal is a political one, not a therapeutic one.
I just want to pause a minute and say who we are. My name is Bill Schechner, and I'm here every morning in place of Larry Josephson, who's on vacation. And this morning I'm talking to Herb Needleman, who's a psychiatrist from Philadelphia. That's better than a Philadelphia lawyer, right?
Yeah.
Philadelphia doctor doesn't quite carry the stigma.
Yeah.
And he's a member of the Committee for Responsibility, which is a unit of physicians who have concerned themselves with the quality of medical care for civilians in Vietnam and have worked to bring severely injured victims of the war to this country for rehabilitation. And we're talking about the committee, and particularly right now about the medical problems of the Vietnamese civilians, a problem which is almost never talked about in the papers. I think that's one of the major running journalistic scandals of the war, that what you've described, the hospital system that you've described, inherited from the French, sounds 16 hospitals for the entire population.
44.
44 hospitals. 44
provincial hospitals.
For 16 million people.
For 16 million people. And then there's some private hospitals,
right,
too. But that's the provincial governmental hospital system.
And that inherited from the French. And so a system based upon... for one thing, based upon a paternalistic notion, I'm sure that people will take care of themselves, or large property holders will take care of those who get sick on their properties, and so on and so forth. And much more important than that, not in any respect adequate to deal with a war situation. What yeah. happens, what is the total capacity of those hospitals? Do you have any estimate?
Oh, I did. That figure escapes me at this moment. No, I wouldn't want to be inaccurate about it. I think there might be 3,000 beds or more, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be inaccurate about that. I do know that there are 44 provincial hospitals that vary greatly in size. Let me, I agree with you that one of the major scandals is that there has been decreasing attention paid to the human cost of the war in this country, and the medical situation has received almost no attention in the past year or two. The initial spotlight was thrown on this issue by Neil Sheehan, who was the Times correspondent in Vietnam. The Times at that point was doing, I think, some very vigilant coverage of Vietnam. Their coverage has decreased in intensity, I think, in the past year or so, and I think this may be true for many other newspapers.
One of their guys there now, James Sturba, is one of their young Turk
yeah.
correspondents.
Good reporter.
Yeah. You've met him?
No, I've read
this. Yeah, his stuff is much better than anything that's come out of Saigon in the Times in a couple of months. But I don't want to talk about that.
Right. But, I think it's very important, and I think this is an important task for the Committee of Responsibility, in addition to direct care, is to call attention to the war in terms of its human costs, the human terms of it. Not the body counts, not the geopolitical hogwash that we hear, but that this war is something that is being done to people, a very beautiful people, by our people. And we're paying dues for that, too. We're paying increasingly severe dues for what we are perpetrating there. I lecture to Philadelphia police rookies as part of my work in community psychiatry. And about 30 to 40% of those men are Vietnam veterans. One of my seminars with them is on violence. And some extraordinarily interesting and to some degree frightening things have emerged. Let me tell you about that. In a recent series of 8 hours, I began by talking about problems in the city, and one of the new recruits, the first question asked me was, do I think society's falling apart? I said, that's a very interesting question. I didn't expect to hear it in this group of 70 men. What do you think? He says, yes, I do. I think that the fabric is falling apart. There were a lot of young recruits who felt that way. So I went into a discussion of the critical issues that this country must face and contrasted that with the way we are assessing our priorities and talked about $100 billion being spent in Vietnam to kill people. And I came back the next session. A young man stood up, which is very unusual, and said, Doctor, you said some things that disturbed some of us in this room when you said we spent $100 billion to kill people. What did you mean by that? Well, I asked how many people had been to Vietnam, and about 30%. And I established that I'd been there, too. We'd been to some similar places, so we had a common language. And I laid out my case for this. There was a great deal of responsiveness to this. I then said that the next session was going to deal with violence, and I wanted them to ask themselves why the human organism was the only animal that tortured, that made piles of its enemies' skulls, or cut off ears for trophies. And when I saw them in the next session, I did give a fairly academic lecture on some experimental studies on violent behavior. And at the break, this guy came up to me, and he said, he asked me if I thought it was sick behavior to cut off ears. And I said, why'd you ask for it? And he said, well, he had. In fact, all of his buddies had up at Dung Ha. It was common behavior. He said, I did it. She was dead, Doc. With a kind of sick smile on his face, I said, like a good psychiatrist, I said, how do you feel about it? He says, I don't feel anything. I wanted to bring it home, put it on my rear view mirror, and let my wife see it. I said, I was really at a loss for words. I did not know how to
respond. Was that a joke, or was that...
No, he was deadly serious about it. He was embarrassed, but he was deadly serious. He wanted to put the ear on his rear view mirror. At the next session, I opened this up with the guys. I said, we have a good sense of rapport. We talk freely. So some of the men had remarked this. And I said, in that sense, I'm going to break the confidence and talk about a private conversation I had with one of you, because I think it's extraordinarily important. Every combat soldier in that room had seen or been involved in atrocities. They were of very mixed feelings about them. Some guys were ashamed. Some guys felt that this is it. This is war, and they had seen their buddies submitted to mutilations, the bodies of dead buddies. Five guys, I asked how many had directly seen and not heard reports of it. Five guys had. And I kept saying that I am concerned about this because these men in the room are going to have people who are completely helpless, under their complete control, with their hands cuffed behind them, people that they will be angry about, people that they will have been afraid of before they apprehended them, and many of them had this kind of experience of cutting off ears or other things. And what were the implications of this for future police work? I think that's something that we all ought to think about, and I think it's something we all ought to realize, that a whole host of guys, over 2 million guys, are coming back, many of whom will have been taught that counterterror in the service of political goals is legitimate. And many of them are going to be policemen, for one. Some of these guys were concerned about it, others felt that it was perfectly normal behavior. That's the kind of dues that we're paying because of this war.
It's hard to follow that with another question. Let's talk a little bit about the civilians who don't make it to the hospitals. And then after that, I want to talk about your encounters with the Vietnamese and American officials there and the committee's work in trying to get some of these people brought out.
Sure.
And after that, we'll do some phone calls. So those who want to talk to Dr. Needleman will get a chance later on. What about the civilians who don't make it to the hospitals? And they must be enormous numbers of them.
Yeah, well, nobody has a real good handle on it. We can only guess at it. We did a study in I Corps in the first region again. A young Harvard medical student went under our sponsorship about a year ago and simply asked with somebody, an American who spoke Vietnamese, asked of each patient, where do you live? Where were you living when the bomb or the bullet struck? How many in your family survived? We discovered this, that the people in the hospital in the main came from an area of a very small radius outside the hospital. Perhaps the hospital in general was draining only one-third of the province, or less. The very narrow strip around the hospital was serving most of the patients were served from that area. And that a significant number of patients reported that other members of their family were killed or haven't seen them since. So that our estimate is that at least for each patient in the hospital, there are at least two, probably many more, who don't. Now, a lot of those just die. There are a lot of dead Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those are listed in our body counts as Viet Cong. If it is dead and not white, it's a Viet Cong, is a common kind of shibboleth. A lot of them, I think, are treated in the NLF village clinics. We've heard about those. I've never seen one. I've never been that far out in the field, and I wouldn't go at this point if I could. And goodness knows how many others are dead. We do know that, just to give you another index, in 1967, the government of Vietnam reported that there were 40,000 amputees in the country. In World War II, our military suffered only 20,000 amputees, so the Vietnamese population has officially sustained twice the number of amputees of our entire army. And you can't turn a corner in Vietnam without seeing an amputee. Mm-hmm. They don't take the time to produce artificial arms because they're a luxury item. They're not able to cope with the need for artificial legs.
Is this the kind of injury? I guess really the question I'm asking is, since these are war injuries, they're going to be either burn cases, which are extremely delicate to deal with.
Right.
Burn is one of the, medically speaking, is one of the most difficult things to treat, isn't it?
It's tough, sure. The
pathophysiology
is very difficult, right.